This is VOA News, your production.
I'm Laurel Bowman. The United States intends to revoke the Houthi movement's terrorist designation in response to Yemen's humanitarian crisis, reversing one of the Trump administration's most criticized last-minute decisions. The move was confirmed by a State Department official a day after U.S. President Joe Biden declared a halt to U.S. support for the Saudi Arabia-led military campaign in Yemen, which is widely seen as a proxy conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Iran's foreign minister urged Washington to act fast to return to the nuclear accord, pointing out that legislation passed by parliament forces the government to harden its nuclear stance if U.S. sanctions are not eased by February 21st. Mohammad Zarif also referred to elections in Iran in June. If a hardline president is elected, this could further jeopardize the deal. Access to loans on favorable terms will be crucial to Africa's economic recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic, South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa said on Saturday. The president, who is the outgoing chair of the African Union, told the Bloc Summit that even though the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have deployed significant financial resources for the coronavirus outbreak response, more needed to be done. Italy's League leader Matteo Salvini said the right-wing party would decide next week whether to back a government led by Mario Draghi, but that common ground had emerged in discussions on Saturday. Salvini was speaking to reporters after meeting with Draghi, the former European Central Bank chief. For more on these stories, please visit voanews.com. This is VOA News. Libya embarked Saturday on a new phase of its post-Qaddafi transition after an interim executive was selected to lead the country until December elections, all this following a decade of chaos in that country. In a potential turning point widely welcomed by the international community, four new leaders from Libya's west, east, and south now face the task of unifying a nation torn apart by two rival administrations and countless militias. At UN-led talks outside of Geneva, 75 Libyan delegates also selected an interim prime minister. Libya has been mired in violent turmoil with divisions between the GNA government in Tripoli and a rival administration backed by military strongman Khalifa Haftar in the east. Acting UN envoy Stephanie Williams, who facilitated the talks in Switzerland, called the new accord an historic moment. Thousands of protesters backed by Tunisia's powerful labor union gathered in central Tunis on Saturday in the country's biggest demonstration for years, defying a police lockdown that blocked roads in a large area of the capital. The rally was held to mark the anniversary of the 2013 killing of a prominent activist and to protest against police abuses that demonstrators say have imperiled freedoms won in the 2011 revolution that triggered the Arab Spring. A decade after Tunisia's revolution, its political system is mired in endless squabbling between the president, prime minister, and parliament, while the economy stagnates. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu described on Saturday a decision by the International Criminal Court as pure anti-Semitism, hours after judges at the ICC found the court has jurisdiction over war crimes committed in the Palestinian territories, paving the way for a possible criminal investigation, despite Israeli objections. The decision prompted swift reactions from both Israel, which is not a member of the court and rejects its jurisdiction, and the Palestinian Authority, which welcomed the ruling. The ICC judges said their decision was based on the fact that Palestine has been granted membership to the tribunal's founding treaty and had referred the situation to the court. The judges said the jurisdiction decision does not imply any attempt to determine Palestinian statehood, which is uncertain, or national borders. And a Chinese space probe sends back its first image of Mars as it prepares to touch down on the red planet later this year. The remote. Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, via Skype, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's Regional Director for the Americas, and our moderator is Dan Raviv, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Joe Biden has been busy as 46th president of the United States, issuing a series of executive orders meant to reverse some of the key policies of the man he defeated in the last election, Donald Trump. And the United States Senate is about to put Mr. Trump on trial, an impeachment trial, even though the accused is no longer president and he won't be at the trial. The coronavirus crisis, the number of deaths per day here in the United States, has been declining a little, as well as the number of COVID-19 victims being treated in hospitals. But there is huge concern about variants or mutations of COVID-19. Officials admit they have to find a way to speed up the process of vaccinating Americans to protect them from this virus. And other major news in the past week or so, let's begin with President Biden. He has said he wants to be bipartisan, meaning he, as a Democrat, would work with Republicans. He met with 10 Republican senators in the White House, but President Biden says on his top priorities, including $1.9 trillion he wants Congress to approve to fight COVID-19 and to help boost the U.S. economy, he will push for passage, even if it's only by Democrats. Josh Glancy, with all the bitter divisions in U.S. politics, is Mr. Biden really trying to be bipartisan?
Yeah, that's the great question at the moment, isn't it? I think in his heart of hearts, he does really want to be bipartisan. But at the same time, this coronavirus relief bill is urgently needed. And I think there's a real sense that they need to use their momentum out the gate. As president, you know, in the first 100 days, there's always a time when you want to get a lot done. The country needs the money. And the economy needs the money. And so I think there is a genuine desire for bipartisanship, particularly from the top, from President Biden. But at the same time, they're not willing to get dragged down into the trenches and take too long to get this bill passed or to sacrifice too much of it. There has been an offer from 10 Republican senators, and they are working with the president. There was a long meeting in the Oval Office. You know, these are people that Biden knows well from his time in the Senate. These are the kinds of deals that he spent his career working on and hammering out. There is the possibility for some kind of consensual compromise, but I wouldn't necessarily hold out too much hope. As I said, they're very keen to get this through very fast, and they want it to be big, and they feel like compromising it is compromising what the American people need. That's the sense that Democrats have around this. It's definitely up in the air whether we'll see any real compromise.
Well, politics is usually the art of compromise, but one wonders about the past 4 years. Everything was so bitter and difficult. Abdulrahim Fukara, what's your view? Do you think Joe Biden, above all, is trying to reverse what Donald Trump did during his term?
There are strong indicators that he is. Many of the executive orders that he has signed seem to go in that direction. Ultimately, the executive orders would have to percolate through Congress in one way or another at some point or other. And that will bring us back to the issue of bipartisanship, how much he can successfully push through Congress. I wanted to say that given the contentious election that the country has gone through, but in particular, given what happened on the 6th of January with the storming of Congress, one would have expected a greater sense of urgency on the sides of both parties to work together. After all, it takes two to tango. But the country is not there. It seems that, you know, the divide is as sharp as ever today, even when Joe Biden is trying to draw attention to the urgency of the stimulus package that he wants Congress to deal with. And if I may also add, the issue of bipartisanship, the fact that he is accused now by Republicans, Joe Biden, that is, of not actually being genuine about bipartisanship. It seems to me that in the world we live in today, post January the 6th, there is a big difference between bipartisanship in Congress and uniting Americans. The two parties may be divided in Congress about a whole host of issues. They may not even find a bridge to bipartisanship. But it could be his calculus, Joe Biden's calculus, that moving beyond the legislation in Congress, if he manages to get the stimulus package passed by Congress, even by a slim Democratic majority, ultimately the aid that he wants to offer to Americans, it reaches left, right, and center, including the supporters of Donald Trump. I don't know ultimately if that is his calculation, but all I'm saying is that in today's world post January the 6th, there may be a difference between wanting to unite Americans and wanting to be bipartisan in Congress.
One thought when it comes to uniting the country is whether Joe Biden will choose issues where he thinks there could be a national consensus. But on the other hand, this past Tuesday, he was working on the subject of illegal immigration, and basically by signing some orders which give the United States a much softer policy toward people entering this country from Latin America, typically without visas. For instance, he ordered that efforts be made to reunite children, apparently thousands, who were separated from their parents. They had crossed in from Mexico. The parents typically were arrested and then expelled from the U.S. The kids were held separately. And so the Biden White House thinks this is a humanitarian issue that everyone would get behind. But as soon as you talk about immigration, it tends to be divisive. Josh?
Well, I think the issue of child reunification is not divisive. You know, that was one of the worst policies, really, of the Trump era. It was badly executed. And it was badly responded to in the sense that they didn't properly go to the ends of the earth to reunify children with their families, which is not acceptable. So I think it's really important that Biden's getting behind that, and whatever children haven't been unified with their families hopefully will be. And that's, you know, a nice feel-good win for them as well. On the broader issue of immigration, yes, that is likely to be quite divisive, particularly they're opening up a path to citizenship for something like 11 million illegal immigrants currently in America. There will be a lot of people who oppose that, but they lost the elections. And unfortunately, we're in this situation now in America where instead of trying to pass a comprehensive immigration bill through Congress, which is what the country needs, really, that takes into account lots of different interest groups, presidents are ruling by executive fiat here. Trump did it with his wall, with his child separation stuff, with his Muslim ban. And Joe Biden is now doing the same, which may satisfy Democrats in the short term, but it doesn't resolve any of the long-term issues. And it means that the next president can equally undo his work. So it's a bit of a sort of pendulum politics, really.
There's also the issue of whether to punish Donald Trump, the only president in U.S. history to be impeached twice by the House of Representatives. Before he left office on January 20th, the House of Representatives voted to impeach Mr. Trump for a second time on a charge that he had incited the violence inside the Capitol building on January 6th. Pro-Trump rioters, who insisted their hero was defeated in the election because of cheating, invaded the Capitol. At least five people died, including one police officer beaten to death. This past Tuesday, Officer Brian Sicknick's remains were brought to the famous rotunda of the Capitol building under the famous dome, lying in honor, saluted by police, by members of Congress, by staff members, in effect thanking police for protecting them on January 6th. President Biden and his wife Jill came and stood briefly in silence. Normally, after a president is impeached by the House, the U.S. Constitution calls on the Senate to hold a trial, even if the president has left office. This has never happened before, but just about everything about Donald Trump defies conventional history. And yet the usual punishment, removing a president from office, is irrelevant. It's moot. He's already out. Abdurrahim?
In working my way to that, to offer a thought on what Josh said just a little while ago about pendulum politics, because pendulum politics is not just a huge problem for Americans internally. It's also a huge problem externally. I mean, you have the rest of the world watching now. Successive American presidents come and change U.S. policy. You had, for example, Trump. He came and he tore apart the nuclear deal with Iran. And now Biden is trying to reroute back to it in one way or another. And then you have these executive orders which Biden has signed, and the whole world will be wondering, will they stand, or will the next U.S. president cancel them? So that's one level of it. The other level is what happens to Donald Trump. think that the whole thing about bipartisanship and uniting Americans that we're talking about, it has a time tag to it, because Donald Trump is no longer the U.S. president, obviously, but he is now trying to consolidate his influence inside the United States by consolidating his influence over the Republican Party. And that would obviously pose a huge problem for the American political system, but also for Joe Biden. And we're already seeing this in Congress, whether it's about the impeachment of Donald Trump, which looks unlikely to yield the result that the Democrats want, or the controversy about Liz Cheney, who had supported the impeachment, although she is a Republican, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, who seems to hold conspiracy theories and is strongly supported by Donald Trump, who is pushing the Republicans to support her as well. So there's a very strange concoction of political stuff going on now in the United States.
The Biden White House doesn't want to make it appear as though the president wants to punish his predecessor. That would be a bad look for the United States. But Democrats in the United States Senate are hoping that in the impeachment trial, they might at least win a vote to ban Donald Trump from ever again running for public office. There's a lot more to discuss here on Issues in the News after this brief break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. Abdelrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's Regional Director for the Americas, and our moderator, Dan Raviv, columnist for Newsday.
The coronavirus crisis has become a kind of race in many countries, including here in the United States. COVID-19 keeps spreading, but vaccines have been invented and are being distributed. The Biden administration does seem frustrated that the pace of administering the vaccines has been slower than officials had hoped. The 50 individual states were allowed to make their own plans, so there hasn't been a clear national vaccination program. Abdelrahim, does this look like a failure so far? Or perhaps we should mostly appreciate the almost miraculous work by scientists that produced vaccines. At least they've been invented.
I think scientists have done a tremendous job to get this country and other countries around the world to where they are today. But since we're talking about the United States, when you recall the amount of time that it took the US to come up with vaccines throughout the history of vaccines, and you compare that with the speed with which vaccines for the coronavirus have been produced, obviously there's tremendous credit in that to US scientists. But to be fair, for all his failings, there's also maybe some credit to be given to Donald Trump, because he may have failed the country in terms of helping it prevent the kind of dizzying spread of the coronavirus throughout the months. But he also pushed very hard to get vaccines. Biden has made pledges to be more efficient in dealing with the virus situation in the United States and the vaccines. And as we've heard from Dr. Fauci recently, the country needs to be vaccinated. 85% of the country, he said, needs to be vaccinated before you can say it's all under control. Up to this point in time, according to Fauci again, only 2% of the U.S. population has been vaccinated. So that gives you a sense of both the hope, but also the challenges awaiting the Biden administration.
Dr. Tony Fauci was talking about the need to vaccinate, as you say, about 85% of Americans in order to return to normal day-to-day life. Americans are already thinking about when will they go back to their workplaces and to theaters, cinemas, sports stadiums. Seems a long way off. And Josh, we combine that with reports that there are still parts of the American population who don't believe in vaccines or don't believe that these vaccines are safe. In other words, Americans who may refuse ever to get the shot or the jab.
Yeah, certainly the somewhat chimeric goal of herd immunity, this idea that we're going to really have the population fully inoculated from the virus, does seem ambitious, certainly this year. I think there's a race of vaccines against variants. We've seen different mutations of the virus coming out of South Africa, Brazil, England, which are going to potentially make it harder for some of the vaccines to work, although not impossible, it seems. Certainly, you do have some anti-vax sentiment. It's been notable even among people working in care homes, among even nurses, that some people haven't been confident about the vaccines or confident in their relationship to American medicine to take the vaccine. This is going to be a long haul. You know, some people are talking 2, 3, 4 years now. That isn't to sound too downcast. America is vaccinating now at about 1.5 million a day. Hopefully it can accelerate beyond that. A lot of people will be immune to this virus soon, and a lot of people will have their lives saved by these vaccines. It's not going to be perfect. It's going to be messy. It's going to take a long time. At the beginning of this pandemic, we all hoped there would be an end date and we could all go and have a big party and get on with our lives. I think we've all come to see that that's not how this ends. But, you know, we have vaccines. We can adapt these vaccines to new variants. It is a long, messy fight ahead of us, but we have the tools to win it. And so I think we can all take some heart from that.
Many officials of the Biden administration say that economic recovery depends on beating the coronavirus, and that's why, well, frankly, that would take time. But in the meantime, the president is forming his cabinet. The U.S. Senate has voted to confirm some of the key nominees. So now we have a new Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. He's a longtime advisor to Joe Biden. Blinken had senior jobs also in the Barack Obama administration. And he's considering changes to U.S. foreign policy, for instance, on Iran. The president and Secretary Blinken would like to find a way to re-enter the nuclear accord that was reached in 2015. President Trump left that deal in 2018. We'll see if any talks with Iran will happen. On the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, the State Department said that the U.S. will oppose Israel's expansion of Jewish settlements in the West Bank, a land captured by Israel in 1967. The Trump administration was never critical of Israel on that issue. Also, the U.S. will oppose, it says, any Palestinian encouragement of violence, including payments made to the families of alleged terrorists captured or killed by Israel. Abdurrahim, there seems to be a move here to make U.S. policy, for instance, in the Middle East, more even-handed and to move away from the way Trump approached these issues.
Well, absolutely. And that takes me back to Josh's earlier point about pendulum politics. I mean, a lot of the policies pursued by the Trump administration, you mentioned two of them, Iran and Israel-Palestine, they are now under scrutiny by the Biden administration with a view to actually changing them. To what extent or how much of those policies the Biden administration will be able or willing to change? Obviously, there are indications that in the case of Israelis and Palestinians, for example, the embassy in Jerusalem will stay, the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem will stay in Jerusalem. Biden is not niggling about that. So in the case of Iran, the hurdles for going back to an accord are enormous. They're staggering. There's obviously opposition from the Israelis. There's opposition from the Saudis. There are a lot of concerns, not just about the nuclear deal. There are a lot of concerns here in Washington and in other capitals in the Middle East about Iran's influence throughout the Middle East. Nonetheless, Biden wants to go back to some sort of understanding with the Iranians. At the end of the day, even if he reaches an agreement, unless he can get the Senate to adopt it as a treaty, we could be back to pendulum politics. Another president reneging on any agreement that Biden may achieve with the Iranians down the road.
As for U.S. relations with other so-called great powers, so far it seems the Biden administration is taking a hard line toward China, emphasizing human rights more than the Trump administration generally did. In Southeast Asia, when the military seized power in Myanmar, the U.S. government condemned the coup and demanded that the Nobel Peace Prize winner, the elected leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, be released from detention. That was a quick and strong stand that, again, I don't think Donald Trump would have intervened, but the Biden administration is showing a return to the old concerns about human rights around the world. Josh Glancy, what's your take on that?
The question really around this is, you've seen a change of language, undoubtedly and expectedly. We're talking the language of human rights again. We're talking the language of, you know, America as a liberal humanitarian superpower that will seek to promote those values all over the world and push back against authoritarianism. But are they actually going to do much to follow through on that? You know, can they do much? Trump, in some ways, didn't care, but he was also something of an arch pragmatist, if you like, when it came to foreign policy, in that he didn't think that America could do much or had any business to do much in places like Myanmar. So it's good to see Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, restating America's commitment to promoting human rights. But in reality, how much can they do? I mean, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi was imprisoned in her house for many years until recently by the military in Burma and in Myanmar, sorry, and she may well be again. There is a distinction here between language and reality. And the reality is, the Biden administration is dealing with the same world and the same set of powers and the same balance of power that the Trump administration was. How much they can really change that, particularly when it comes to superpowers like Russia or China, is up for debate, I think. And I think they are learning the limitations of that as they come into power.
Let's talk about some strange trading on American stock exchanges. The equity or shares of companies that had no reason to suddenly go way up soared in value. The movie theater chain AMC, BlackBerry, above all, the video game shops called GameStop. It seems that often at 4 o'clock in the morning, conferring online on messaging boards, investors, we think of them as small investors, discover that by acting together, buying the shares and options, they could force large investment groups known as hedge funds to give up their negative positions on those stocks, and then the stocks would go up. Hedge funds, in fact, lost billions of dollars. Some of the so-called little guys made millions. But Abdurrahim, the reputation of America's stock market has been damaged. Would you agree?
I would. It's like in U.S. politics that we were talking about a little while ago. I mean, you get these crazy fluctuations over a very short period of time at the stock exchange, and you have a rush of people described as regular Americans trying to buy GameStop shares, and then to have the shares actually plummet, and then to regain a little bit more strength again, and then to plummet again, leaving those millions of supposedly ordinary Americans in the lurch at a time when they, in particular, as ordinary Americans, need all the help that they can get with the economic situation and the pandemic. Americans, as you know, are divided in trying to understand exactly what happened. I've seen theories that ordinary American movements harking back to the Occupy Wall Street are basically trying to bring down the system of Wall Street as dominated by big money.
Josh, I felt that those little guys getting together without apparently old-fashioned financial experts, it was kind of a populist movement, like a mob deciding to do some damage to the large establishment investors, also hoping to make some money. And I guess maybe have some fun. How did you see it?
Yeah, I mean, certainly that was one aspect of it. Another aspect of it was that there are some pretty smart investors out there who did also get together and back GameStop and then pull out when the profits were highest. And a lot of people that lost money in this were ordinary people stuck at home during the pandemic, maybe playing around with their stimulus checks or whatever. It's dangerous to trade on a volatile stock like that. Although it looks populist, it's kind of a meme populism, if you like. It's an internet populism. It comes and it goes. It's evanescent. It doesn't last very long. And I think some real people did get hurt. And I think that it's not really a realistic way of reforming the financial system, of addressing economic inequality in America. I think a lot of people just found it quite emotionally satisfying to see the big boy hedge funders get a kicking. But long term, they're still going to profit. And a lot of ordinary Americans lost a lot of money.
And that's how the stock markets made headlines. That's all the time we have. But we do thank our panelists, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the British newspaper, The Sunday Times, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's Regional Director for the Americas. This program is produced here in Washington by The Voice of America. I'm Dan Raveep.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, Jonathan and I bring you two reports. One is about a rare medical procedure. The other is about flower sales during the Lunar New Year. Later, Armin Kasabian answers a question from a learner. We close our show with an American story. This week, it is The Lady or the Tiger. But first, a rare face and hands transplant changed Joe DiMeo's life 6 months ago. A transplant is a medical operation in which an organ or body part is removed from one person and attached to another person. DiMeo is 22 years old and comes from the state of New Jersey. He had the operation last August. He received the new face and hands 2 years after being badly burned in a car crash. Today, he is relearning how to do simple movements. He works on smiling and opening and closing his eyes. With his new hands, he is relearning actions like squeezing and pinching. "I knew it would be baby steps all the way," DiMeo told the Associated Press. "You've got to have a lot of motivation, a lot of patience, and you've got to stay strong through everything." Experts say the operation appears to be a success, but they warn it will take some time to know for sure. Doctors at New York University's Medical Center, NYU Langone Health, performed the surgery. Worldwide, surgeons have completed at least 18 face transplants and 35 hand transplants. Those numbers come from the United Network for Organ Sharing, which oversees the U.S. transplant system. But it is extremely rare to get a face and double hand transplant at the same time. The operation had only been tried 2 times before. The first attempt was in 2009 on a patient in Paris, France. That patient died 1 month later from problems related to the surgery. 2 years later, doctors in Boston, Massachusetts, attempted the operation on a woman who had been attacked by a chimpanzee. Days later, doctors had to remove the hand. Dr. Bogdan Pomahak is a surgeon at Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital. He led the second attempt. "The fact that they could pull it off is phenomenal," he said of the doctors who operated on DiMeo. DiMeo will have to take medications for the rest of his life to prevent his body from rejecting the transplants. He also will continue with treatment and exercises to help him gain sensation and movement in his new face and hands. In 2018, DiMeo fell asleep while driving, he said, after working overnight as a product tester for a drug company. His car hit the edge of the street and then a structure. It rolled over and caught on fire. Another driver who saw the accident pulled over to rescue DiMeo from the burning car. After the accident, doctors used drugs to keep him in a deep sleep called a coma. He had 20 surgeries and special operations on his skin to treat his extensive burns. His doctors realized, however, that usual surgeries could not help DiMeo regain use of his face, eyes, or hands. So, his medical team began preparing for the risky transplants in early 2019. But almost immediately, the NYU team dealt with difficulties, including finding a donor. Doctors estimated DeMayo only had a 6% chance of finding a donor whose hands and face would work for his immune system. Doctors also wanted to find someone of the same sex and skin color. During the search for a donor, the COVID-19 health crisis hit. Organ donations dropped sharply. During New York City's increase in virus cases, doctors in the transplant area in the hospital were asked to work with COVID-19 patients instead. In early August, the team finally identified a donor in Delaware. The 23-hour operation happened a few days later. Dr. Eduardo Rodriguez led the medical team of more than 140 people. He said that, so far, DeMayo has not shown any signs of rejecting his new face or hands. Since leaving the hospital in November, DeMayo has been working with rehabilitation specialists to relearn many physical movements. DeMayo, who lives with his parents, can now dress and feed himself. He can take part in some sports. He can also play with his dog, Buster. "You got a new chance at life," DeMayo said. "You really can't give up."
The Lunar New Year holiday is usually a busy time for flower farms in Hong Kong. The farms prepare to sell plum blossoms, orchids, and daffodils at flower markets during the cheerful season. But the coronavirus pandemic and restrictions on such markets this year has affected many farms. Farmers worry that they may be left with an oversupply of flowers. Lunar New Year fairs, known as flower markets in Cantonese, are usually held before the holidays. Thousands of flower sellers and goods dealers sell their products to the public. This year, the Hong Kong government will place restrictions on such markets. They will only be permitted to operate with half the usual number of people and must shorten their business hours. The policy concerns farm owners like Yung Shu Lung. He runs one of Hong Kong's largest orchid farms. He had grown over 30,000 pots of orchids in 10 greenhouses in Hong Kong's rural New Territories area to prepare for the Lunar New Year holiday. Young had first planned to have 16 selling spaces in flower markets. Now he is planning other ways to sell his supply of orchids, including selling them online or urging buyers to visit the farms directly. Lunar New Year traditionally brings an increase in sales for some businesses in Hong Kong. There is usually a big seasonal sale of goods such as holiday foods, gifts, and home decorations, which often include flowers. Flower farms like Young's usually make about 50% of their profits from the Lunar New Year season alone, says business expert Francis Lun. Pinky Chan is one of Young's customers who drove an hour to his farm to buy orchids. Chan thought it was still important to create a cheerful atmosphere during difficult times. "We Chinese people feel happier if our homes are filled with red and green during the Lunar New Year," Chan said. "Because of the pandemic,
We are all not very happy. We are not able to meet with our families. So I hope buying a pot of flowers for my parents can make them feel a bit happier.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Hamiru, who is in Brazil. Hello, could you tell me the difference between a task and an assignment? And how do we use them in our daily life? Thank you. Dear Hamiru, as you may know, both task and assignment are nouns describing an activity that you must complete. A task is something you have to do. An assignment is usually a task that someone gives you to do. A task describes an activity that can be done in your daily life, but you can give a task to yourself, or someone else can give you a task to complete. Any activity you want to finish can become a task. Think about a day in your life and the responsibilities you have. What are the tasks you must do during your day? You can have one task or many tasks. For example,
my task today is to feed the cats before leaving for school.
Tasks are often connected to a bigger goal. Here is an example.
Although learning a computer programming language is a difficult task, I will do my best to study it for my future career.
An assignment means someone is giving you an activity or task to complete. For example, imagine your teacher says,
our test is on Friday, so your assignment tonight is to study everything we learned this past month.
Teachers give students assignments every day. But students need to know how to take a big assignment and separate it into smaller tasks. Students might understand this example.
My assignment is to read the whole book, but luckily, I only need to read 10 pages a day.
Both tasks and assignments are often related to time. For example, we make lists of tasks to better organize our time. For example,
by 12 p.m. today, I need to do the following tasks. Take out the garbage, walk my dog, and go shopping.
Task and assignment are often used in work situations too. If you ever work in a job, the boss may say,
your assignment is to finish all three tasks before the end of the day.
Well, Hamiru, we hope this helps to answer your question. And to our listeners everywhere, what questions do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Armin Kasabian.
Now, the VOA Special English Program, American Stories. We present the short story, The Lady or the Tiger, by Frank R. Stockton. Here is Barbara Klein with the story.
Long ago, in a very olden time, there lived a powerful king. Some of his ideas were progressive, but others caused people to suffer. One of the king's ideas was a public arena as an agent of poetic justice. Crime was punished, or innocence was decided, by the result of chance. When a person was accused of a crime, his future would be judged in the public arena. All the people would gather in this building. The king sat high up on his ceremonial chair. He gave a sign. A door under him opened. The accused person stepped out into the arena. Directly opposite the king were two doors. They were side by side, exactly alike. The person on trial had to walk directly to these doors and open one of them. He could open whichever door he pleased. If the accused man opened one door, out came a hungry tiger, the fiercest in the land. The tiger immediately jumped on him and tore him to pieces as punishment for his guilt. The case of the suspect was thus decided. Iron bells rang sadly. Great cries went up from the paid mourners. And the people, with heads hanging low and sad hearts, slowly made their way home. They mourned greatly that one so young and fair, or so old and respected, should have died this way. But if the accused opened the other door, there came forth from it a woman, chosen especially for the person. To this lady he was immediately married in honor of his innocence. It was not a problem that he might already have a wife and family, or that he might have chosen to marry another woman. The king permitted nothing to interfere with his great method of punishment and reward. Another door opened under the king, and a clergyman, singers, dancers, and musicians joined the man and the lady. The marriage ceremony was quickly completed. Then the bells made cheerful noises. The people shouted happily. And the innocent man led the new wife to his home, following children who threw flowers on their path. This was the king's method of carrying out justice. Its fairness appeared perfect. The accused person could not know which door was hiding the lady. He opened either as he pleased, without knowing whether, in the next minute, he was to be killed or married. Sometimes the fierce animal came out of one door, sometimes it came out of the other. This method was a popular one. When the people gathered together on one of the great trial days, they never knew whether they would see a bloody killing or a happy ending. So everyone was always interested. And the thinking part of the community would bring no charge of unfairness against this plan. Did not the accused person have the whole matter in his own hands? The king had a beautiful daughter who was like him in many ways. He loved her above all humanity. The princess secretly loved a young man who was the best-looking and bravest in the land. But he was a commoner, not part of an important family. One day, the king discovered the relationship between his daughter and the young man. The man was immediately put in prison. A day was set for his trial in the king's public arena. This, of course, was an especially important event. Never before had a common subject been brave enough to love the daughter of the king. The king knew that the young man would be punished, even if he opened the right door. and the king would take pleasure in watching the series of events, which would judge whether or not the man had done wrong in loving the princess. The day of the trial arrived. From far and near, the people gathered in the arena and outside its walls. The king and his advisors were in their places opposite the two doors. All was ready. The sign was given. The door under the king opened, and the lover of the princess entered the arena. Tall, beautiful, and fair, his appearance was met with a sound of approval and tension. Half the people had not known so perfect a young man lived among them. No wonder the princess loved him. What a terrible thing for him to be there. As the young man entered the public arena, he turned to bend to the king. But he did not at all think of the great ruler. The young man's eyes instead were fixed on the princess, who sat to the right of her father. From the day it was decided that the sentence of her lover should be decided in the arena, she had thought of nothing but this event. The princess had more power, influence, and force of character than anyone who had ever before been interested in such a case. She had done what no other person had done. She had possessed herself of the secret of the doors. She knew behind which door stood the tiger and behind which waited the lady. Gold and the power of a woman's will had brought the secret to the princess. She also knew who the lady was. The lady was one of the loveliest in the kingdom. Now and then, the princess had seen her looking at and talking to the young man. The princess hated the woman behind that silent door. She hated her with all the intensity of the blood passed to her through long lines of cruel ancestors. Her lover turned to look at the princess. His eye met hers as she sat there, paler and whiter than anyone in the large ocean of tense faces around her. He saw that she knew behind which door waited the tiger and behind which stood the lady. He had expected her to know it. The only hope for the young man was based on the success of the princess in discovering this mystery. When he looked at her, he saw that she had been successful, as he knew she would succeed. Then his quick and tense look asked the question, "Which?" It was as clear to her as if he shouted it from where he stood. There was not time to be lost. The princess raised her hand and made a short, quick movement toward the right. No one but her lover saw it. Every eye but his was fixed on the man in the arena. He turned, and with a firm and quick step, he walked across the empty space. Every heart stopped beating. Every breath was held. Every eye was fixed upon that man. He went to the door on the right and opened it. Now, the point of the story is this. Did the tiger come out of that door? or did the lady? The more we think about this question, the harder it is to answer. It involves a study of the human heart. Think of it not as if the decision of the question depended upon yourself, but as if it depended upon that hot-blooded princess, her soul at a white heat under the fires of sadness and jealousy. She had lost him, but who should have him? How often in her waking hours and in her dreams had she started in wild terror and covered her face with her hands? She thought of her lover opening the door on the other side of which waited the sharp teeth of the tiger. But how much oftener had she seen him open the other door? How she had ground her teeth and torn her hair when she had seen his happy face as he opened the door of the lady. How her soul had burned in pain when she had seen him run to meet that woman with her look of victory. When she had seen the two of them get married, and when she had seen them walk away together upon their path of flowers, followed by the happy shouts of the crowd, in which her one sad cry was lost. Would it not be better for him to die quickly and go to wait for her in that blessed place of the future? And yet, that tiger, those cries, that blood! Her decision had been shown quickly, but it had been made after days and nights of thought. She had known she would be asked, and she had decided what she would answer, and she had moved her hand to the right. The question of her decision is one not to be lightly considered, and it is not for me to set myself up as the one person able to answer it. And so I leave it with all of you. Which came out of the open door? The lady or the tiger?
You have heard the American story, The Lady or the Tiger, by Frank R. Stockton. Your storyteller was Barbara Klein. This story was adapted into Special English by Shelley Gollist. It was produced by LaJuan Davis. Listen again next week for another American story in VOA Special English. I'm Bob Doty.
That's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.